You're listening to The Write Process, a podcast in which one writer tells the story of completing one work from concept to completion. I'm your host, Charlie Jensen.
Hi, I'm Jeff Bonnett, and I wrote the Netflix movie Falling for Christmas, starring Lindsay Lohan.
Jeff Bonnett is a writer-filmmaker who began his career in Hollywood as a script reader. From there, his first pitch and subsequent screenplay became a film released on the Hallmark Channel in 2015 titled Love by the Book. His latest screenplay, Falling for Christmas, was released on Netflix last November, where it premiered at number one, was in Netflix's top 10 movie list in 92 countries, and was the top U.S. streaming movie across all platforms in its second week running. Before the holiday season ended, it had been viewed over 78 million times globally. Dubbed by IndieWire as the Citizen Kane of Netflix Christmas movies, Falling for Christmas is about a newly engaged, spoiled hotel heiress who suffers from amnesia after a skiing accident and finds herself in the care of a down-on-his-luck widower and his daughter at their quaint ski lodge in the days leading up to Christmas.
I came upon the idea for this movie, Falling for Christmas, way back, believe it or not, in a writer's program class. It was winter 2016. I was in a class with instructor Kate Marciniak called Storytelling from the Script Analyst's POV. That was a class where I came into it with an idea for a Christmas movie, also thinking that with my previous credit of having a romantic comedy out on Hallmark that was released in 2015, that a potential next logical step to kind of earn another credit and move up another rung on the screenwriting ladder career-wise was to write a Christmas movie, potentially for one of the biggest makers of them, which was Hallmark Television. And I had this rather unique idea for a story that involved memory loss. It involved kind of downtrodden husband. He was the central character, and it was somewhat of a complicated plot. It was more along the lines of something like that movie Family Man with Nicolas Cage, also a Christmas movie I admire. It was kind of like that, you know, tonally and everything. And the first week of Kate's class was the assignment to just pitch your story in just one paragraph. And the modality of that class was an asynchronous online class. So you're working on a website and you're interacting similar to a lot of online forums out there where you have your profile and you're typing your work and you're getting responses and interacting with students like that. In that first exercise, I remember it was at night. It was the night before that it was due. I tried to type a succinct paragraph about this concept and make it sound as quick and as gettable as I could. And it just wasn't working. It wasn't clicking. And I was like, holy crap. If I can't do this in one paragraph in a class, there is no chance Hallmark is going to buy this Christmas movie. Not only that, but at that time, I even knew then that 99% of their movies, even back then in 2016, coming off of 2015 Christmas, all of their movies have female leads if they're Christmas movies. Mine did not. The wife character was more of a supporting character role. And I was like, okay, what am I thinking? Like, this is a nice idea. I really do like this idea, but my immediate goal was to get to that point where I could write a commercial script and then have it be made and come out as a Christmas movie. You know what? This has to go on the back burner. And I immediately pivoted and I thought of something much more simple that had to do with that theme of memory loss. And essentially what I came up with on the spot was the movie Overboard at Christmas in a ski resort. I do not shy away from that. I know exactly what I was doing because even back then I had done a degree of my homework and I knew that Hallmark tended to do that. They tended to take some plots from movies that were out there. Namely, I think one of the more popular ones that they had was, you know, like the Groundhog's Day, one day repeating plot, only it was Groundhog's Day at Christmas. Any number of those things. They make tons of Christmas movies every year. So naturally they do this. It was part of their business model. So I knew that this movie really hit that sweet spot. And the more I started thinking about it, the more I started liking the idea. One idea after the next started clicking and the pitch was instantly gettable. You know, I wrote that paragraph in like under 2 minutes or something, right? So that's when this whole project started for me. And then for the duration of her course, I completed a rough outline. After that, it fell by the wayside. I think I started pursuing other classes and other things, and I didn't circle back to it to about a year later. So around Christmas 2017, several things happened that re-sparked my motivation to really pursue writing this Christmas movie. One of them happened to be, I think, something that a lot of people can relate to, which is, you know, as a writer, I do have a day job. And at that particular day job, there were some workplace talks of a reorganization of the company. About 40% of the workforce was worried or scared or uncertain if they would have a job in a few months' time. I was included in that. In that situation, you naturally, you know, start thinking about your future, what's going to be next if I lose my job, or you're calculating how long you can survive off of your severance. All the while, you know, I still had these ambitions creatively to pursue a path in screenwriting and filmmaking. And I was sitting on this idea for a Christmas movie. And I had that pressure already of this could be my one chance. If I calculate my severance and I have this amount of time to survive in a worst case scenario, I could at least be safe, you know, doing this and writing this project before I have to go to plan B and look for the next job to, you know, like any independent artist has to, you know, they have to pay their bills and support themselves and all of that and keep the fight going there. The other thing that happened was I stumbled upon a podcast, which I've also done an interview for with Pilar Alessandra. She's a friend of the writer's program as well. And she has her own podcast called On the Page. And she interviewed a executive from Hallmark Television. Her name was Heather Overton, also the sister of Holly Overton, a writer who was previously interviewed on this podcast. Heather's interview was really eye-opening for me because she just cracked the lid open on the entire Hallmark Christmas movie development cycle in terms of when they accept their pitches to, I think that was probably around January, February every year. And then they would develop them and then sometimes even shoot them in the summertime somewhere with fake snow and release them that Christmas, that same year. And I was just like, wow, it's actually tangible, feasible to pitch a Christmas movie and potentially even get it bought and made in one calendar year from January all through to the next Christmas. And so that really cemented in my brain what could be possible, especially because I was sitting on that very commercial Hallmark type Christmas movie concept and still had that rough outline. At the same time, once that Christmas 2017 rolled around, I noticed not only was Hallmark upping their amount of Christmas movies they were making, you know, there was articles in the trades and you would read the stuff in the news. I think they went from like 40 to 50 that year, something like that, original Christmas movies. So that's a lot of Christmas movies. Knowing that market, the standard other outlets always applied, like Lifetime Channel, Mar Vista was a studio that makes them either for other channels or Amazon Prime or straight to the video. They've always done those. And then Netflix, I noticed, started getting into the Christmas game. At that time, back in Christmas 2017, they pretty much took a page from the Hallmark playbook. You know, they made these very low budget Christmas movies made for a price, just like Hallmark, you know, female driven stories. And they had two out that year. One of them became more of like a viral social media sensation that was called A Christmas Prince. And that was kind of like one of those movies where it was known for being so cheesy and bad that it was good and enjoyable. Campy, I guess. But that one was kind of weird because if it was on Hallmark, people would just take it for granted. It was like a normal Hallmark movie. But I think because it was on Netflix, the expectations were perhaps skewed and people wanted to buy into it more in terms of how it was somewhat cheesy a Christmas movie. The other one was more straight up like a Hallmark movie. It was called A Christmas Inheritance. So I'm watching both of these movies and thinking, oh, wow, Netflix is getting in the game too. So that's another outlet that this thing could potentially go to. You know, I should really get my stuff together and start this project. And then as I was watching those Netflix Christmas movies, I noticed that in the credits, in the opening of each of them, lo and behold, an executive that I used to read scripts for and provide script coverage for in the past was producing these movies. And this person was the first person that opened the door for me years and years ago that let me go from providing script coverage to submitting pitches for movies that were made for television like Hallmark TV. That is how my first film credit came to be, which was a film that was released on Hallmark Television in 2015. I thought, okay, I have a connection at Netflix. I have a movie that was on Hallmark, I can reach out to them. Those are like the top one and two spots. Obviously, Netflix at the time to me had that slightly cooler edge and you would want a movie on Netflix just for like bragging rights more so than Hallmark, but I would have been happy with either one. I knew that chances were good for those. I had some kind of like at least a toe cracking open a door in those two spots. And worst case, there was the other outlets that were out there as well as a plan B to pitch to. So taking in that timeline that Heather kind of outlined in that podcast interview, taking into consideration all of these other Christmas outlets and also having the pressure of like, no, it's now or never. If I'm losing my job or not, this is the time. That Christmas 2017, I just started watching every single Christmas movie that was on the television. Sometimes I would, you know, DVR some and play them back. You know, I'm visiting my family at home and I'm have my laptop open and I'm picking ones that have similar plots and structures and I'm writing outlines like they teach you in every class and every screenwriting book. You know, find movies that are similar to yours and outline them as if you're the one writing them, just to get the story structure down and know how they structure things, especially if it's on television in between all the commercial breaks and all of that. I did that. I've never done that before. And now I'm always going to do it because that's sound advice. It worked like a charm. And I just kind of learned the structure there through osmosis or doing that practice and watching a lot of these Christmas movies, even if it was just passively in the background at times. And I really studied the ones that were on Netflix as well. As soon as January rolled around, January 2018, I just had that development cycle that was described in that podcast interview in the back of my head going, okay, outline, we're starting from scratch. We're going to have that done by the end of January and then be ready to pitch by February. When it came to outlining the script, I think I do what a lot of people do, which is, you know, you do your preliminary research, not only with watching movies that are similar to yours, but also in my case, I already knew that this plot would take place at a luxury ski resort at that, because the main central character is a spoiled rich girl from a wealthy family, and that family owned a very luxury ski resort. So I looked into a little bit about that in terms of like locations and settings and what the ski industry might face nowadays in terms of problems. A common plot thread in a lot of Hallmark type Christmas movies is the small town versus big city, small business versus big business, that type of thing. Sometimes there's always a subplot of some type of perhaps small business to save. So in my case, yeah, it was a mom and pop ski lodge versus the big ski resorts. And that was part of the contrast. You know, the main character suffers from a ski accident, gets amnesia, gets taken into the care of the person who owns the mom and pop ski lodge. So there's that contrast that exists. When you're just starting out, you kind of have this primordial soup of ideas stirring around in your brain, and you just take the notes, whether it's on your phone, noting the random ideas, or on note cards. And then eventually, when it was time to seriously outline, I start with note cards and I clear off my dining room table and I write down all of the scenes and turning points and plot points that I know first. And I kind of map them out. And I already knew that these stories had a 7-act structure for the most part, and what each section of that story would have to accomplish in terms of tracking the love story or tracking the main plot or the subplot. I would write out the ideas that I had, and then sure enough, you're kind of looking like at a roadmap at that point. And then you start having ideas on how to fill in the blanks. And then I'll do a few passes of that. Sometimes I'll just take the note cards away and just write it from scratch in, you know, a Saturday morning and afternoon all over again and see how much I actually remember. And sometimes new ideas come through that process of writing it all over again. And then you have your old note cards to refer to as well. And you can plug in some missing spots that way too. That happens for several rounds. And then at some point, when I think I have enough material, I will just take the final stack of cards and I will sit in front of Microsoft Word and start typing in a way that can be somewhat readable to somebody else. So it's not just shorthand that I can understand. It is a story beginning, middle to end, you know, describing these scenes, sometimes plugging in notable dialogue lines that would be either funny or witty or important, and just going in order like that. And then passing over that again for a few rounds and getting it to a point where it's roughly, I would say, about a 15-page or so single-spaced, what they call treatment or synopsis, a very detailed synopsis, virtually scene for scene what the movie would be when it becomes a screenplay. Doing that, or later when it came time to going from that to doing the draft, I was, you know, working essentially more or less 9 to 5, Monday through Friday, like anybody else. And I was on this very tight timetable. So some of the things that I did were, number one was always bring my laptop to work. And I was commuting by bus at that time because I'm fortunate enough to live in a direct bus line to where I was working. So after every, you know, weeknight, mostly I would just take the laptop, go to the closest Starbucks, sit there, plug away and write the synopsis or later the draft. And then one of the tricks that I have used for a long time is that whether you have a a MacBook or a phone or any kind of device, really, you can create a PDF document and have your phone do a text-to-speech feature back to you and hear whatever you wrote be read aloud. And a lot of the times, especially on the commute times, if I wasn't just reading something, I would just kick back and have either your, whether it's the computer at night when you get home from work and writing, or on the commutes in the morning or in the evenings, just listen, you know, plug my headphones in and listen to passages that were written. So it's almost like you can close your eyes and envision the movie playing out in your head. At the same time, while you're listening to it, other things come to mind, like other ways a line could be said or other story or plot elements that could be inserted here and pay off later. And it's a nice way to kind of keep something a little more alive than just reading the same words on the page over and over and over again and becoming a little bit more numb to that. So all in all, coming into that year 2018 from Christmas and watching those Christmas movies through the outline phase, I was pretty much done with a full-blown treatment by the end of January, maybe early February. And that's when I began putting the feelers out to potentially submit this as a pitch. If Netflix said no, if Hallmark said no, somehow I just knew that it was where it needed to be to land somewhere. But in the back of my head, as any writer, I think, does when you embark upon some type of creative endeavor, you do have this way to like mentally mitigate failure. And so I thought, you know, worst case scenario, if nothing happens with this, I'm still happy with this story. And I know I can take it to a script, even if I do that on my own. And then I will have another very solid writing sample to show that I can at least do this and then maybe use that to get representation of some kind, because back then and even now, I do not have any representatives. I don't have a manager. I don't have an agent. I did this all on my own. Basically, I only had a lawyer to cover the, hopefully, you know, arrive at some kind of negotiation selling phase. And I recommend everybody have a lawyer for that. But I knew at the end of the day that I would at least have this as a potential writing sample to obtain some type of representation later. And it was something I could build off of for my previous credit with Hallmark TV. But my next goal at that time was to do exactly what they tell you to do in classes, which is write query letters over email. That was my pitch process. So that was the next phase. I had the treatment that I was happy with. I knew that it would land somewhere, and it really hit the bullseye in terms of what both Netflix and Hallmark really look for. I had just put some feelers out. I have a very, I wouldn't say like I have this vast, crazy personal network from living and working in LA a long time, but I had a few people that I could turn to that provided me some advice or a referral. But my old personal contact that was at Netflix, they were the first person that I emailed, and I just sent them a quick email. Hey, I have this project, and just the quick log line, saw you were doing these movies, loved them on Netflix. Let me know if you're interested. I immediately got back an automated reply that said this executive was out of the country shooting a movie. And leading up to that first email, you're just like, you know, you have a lot of nerves and anticipation. You're hoping that you'll get a response. So that was not the response I was hoping for. So I was like, rats. Okay. Next, I emailed the same type of short and sweet query letter to a Hallmark executive that was pretty high up there. And the Hallmark executive wrote back immediately. And I was not ready for this. It was a shoot from the hip, almost text message style back. Send me a short synopsis. And I didn't have a short synopsis at that time. I had a 15-page treatment and a log line and nothing in between. So very quickly, I had to whip up a one-page, like four-paragraph synopsis of exactly what this story was from start to finish. Because I had spent so much time actually going over the story in that January, by the time this, you know, we're in mid-February 2018 now, I was able to just crank that out in probably less than 15 minutes. And I'm just thinking like, I got to do this. I have this person's attention. I could never hear from them again. I got to do this now. Sent that off, immediately get another response back. And that reply was, it's too similar to what we did last year. Sorry. It was very close to that. And that would just kind of like really deflated my hopes for like my number one and my number two destination. So I was like, okay, well, back to the drawing board. I guess I'm going to go to these other, you know, plan B, C, D, et cetera. Then, you know, sure enough, within the span of, I think, 2 weeks or less, that executive over at Netflix returned to the country, responded to my email and said, hey, this sounds interesting. This is exactly what we're looking for. You know, I sent her the full material, not only the one page synopsis, which I now have, and note to any listeners out there, always have a one page synopsis ready to go, as well as whatever other material you may have. And then I would say within days, I probably got a phone call that said, this is exactly what we're looking for. Let's do this. from there. That was like maybe late February, early March of that year. We talked briefly on the phone in terms of, hey, this isn't Hallmark. Netflix gives us a lot more leeway. They're looking to do more Christmas movies. You can have more fun with it. Obviously, if anybody is a fan of Hallmark, they know that they're G-rated movies. You can't have a couple waking up in bed together. You can't have people smoking or drinking or anything like that. So the rules are very strict for commercial family-oriented television. And I'm not saying anything that's, you know, top secret. This is obvious if you just watch the channel a lot. They adhere to their business model for many reasons, and they're very successful at what they do. Netflix doesn't have to play by the same rules. So I had a little more, it was basically like that. It was a very brief conversation, and I was just off and running, ready to do the draft. And that's when the drafting process for the script began. Drafting the script spanned roughly from, I think, March of 2018 to the first draft that I delivered was June 1st, 2018. First off, when you have a very detailed outline to work from, kind of like a roadmap to follow, it's still, at least for me, I can't speak for other writers. I've heard other writers on this podcast. I've talked to many writers before. Everybody's different. Everybody has their own process. But for me, going from the outline to the first draft where you're just plugging words in on the page in screenplay format, thinking of what does this room look like? What's the layout of this ski lodge? Who's in this scene? Who's in the background of this scene? What are they doing? What's their role? What do they want? All the minutiae that you have to think about. It's such an uphill slog to go through that first draft. One of the tricks that I've used started back when I did my first movie. I guess it was a product of writing under an extreme deadline, which I did back then. And I was somewhat on a quick deadline right now, the turnaround of about a few months for a draft. I don't start from page one. Even if I have the whole story mapped out in an outline scene for scene, I know that I'm the type that if I start on page one and try to do the opening pages and the whole first act, I'm more of a perfectionist and I'll just stay stuck in that trying to start the movie as perfect as possible. When the truth is, you don't know anything about your movie when you're starting out, or at least me. You don't know what the characters sound like. You don't know other details that happen later that might have to be set up in the first act and included that you didn't even think about. First acts have to be so quick and efficient at setting up what is to come that I just don't start with the first act anymore. I just know where the first act ends, what that first act one plot point number one is, and then I start the draft there. And then I just continue. Typically, especially if you're doing movies like this, the first half of the first act is more of the fun and games type of scenes or sequences. And not only are they easier to start with, but starting from that point and moving forward will inevitably influence what you need and don't need in a first act. So then I'll circle back at the very end and then do the first act. That I've learned saves, at least saves me a lot of time in the draft process. So spanning from, I want to say March to maybe mid-April was that first rough draft. And when I say first rough draft, it's not something that you would share. It's not something you would share to friends. It is a piece of crap. It's like scenes aren't working. The rhythm's not there. You just like laid brick and you have to smooth everything over. But that's part of the good side of the process is that like you just have something there to sculpt and work from. And if you're working under a deadline, you kind of just blaze through it and push through it because you have to. You're not hung up on making things perfect. But then once it's on paper, it's a lot easier, at least for me, to rewrite than just write from a blank page. Like I said before, when you can either play it back aloud on whatever device you have or just read it back, that's the point where the draft starts telling you sometimes what the movie needs and how a scene should go, or you get additional ideas for funny lines or moments of romance or conflict and all of that. Polishing it up after that to get to the readable first draft that you would show people is a lot easier of a process. And again, I was adhering to the same schedule, working during the day, writing at night, listening to the thing, making notes on the commute. Either I was reading it on my phone, either a PDF or also Final Draft. They have a nice mobile app now where you can sometimes make some minor changes on your portable device. The draft that I delivered the start of June, in the back of my head, I'm thinking, well, this is great. And this could film in the summer and potentially get made. I submitted that. And even that early draft, the story was intact from that point until the release of the film. At this stage, I'm just working with the one executive that I know, that I'm familiar with, who has a very keen sense of story, and especially what that studio and that production company, what they need and what they like to make, and also knowing what Netflix likes to make. Just to rewind for a moment, they have a very similar development cycle and system, only instead of Hallmark, where everything's internal, this place that was making those Christmas movies for Netflix at that time, and still, what they do is they have writers writing a small number of projects that they like, that they think could potentially be something. And then this production company develops them with those writers, and then they'll package them. And I don't mean package in the sense of like William Morris or CAA getting movie stars attached and trying to get a high profile project going. I just mean in the basic sense of like, they know what they can make at a given budget in a given time frame and when they could have a movie available for release. And then Netflix says, oh, you know, we like this one and this one, let's do those. And then it goes to the next level of development where it's essentially in some stage of a green light where it's like, okay, now we're in business. This will at some point be ready to come out on Netflix. Their calendar year of development was very similar to Hallmark in the sense that they did develop from January to early summer, late spring. And then in the summertime, movies do get selected. It was a little later than I expected because I was really gunning to turn in a draft by the start of June. The one development note that I got back was more romance was needed. So I added a scene in the middle that really tied that together better in terms of establishing a more of a romantic connection between the male and female leads. That became the, I believe, the charity gift wrapping scene. That was it. And I knew that around August was the time where they were collecting these scripts and sending them off to Netflix. So by the time I did my part, I was just praying that this would go through. Again, because at the time, I still wasn't sure if I'd have a job in a month or a year or however long this workplace drama was going to last. Thankfully, that drama dissipated. That entire company reorganization did not happen. There was a change in leadership, and I was able to continue working. Right around, I think, late August of that summer, 2019, I finally heard back. The email that I got back, obviously, you know, as a writer, you submit something, you're like, wow, this is actually going to Netflix. This could be real. This could be happening. And you want to hear some good news. I did not get good news. I got an email that just said, we submitted your script. They really, really loved it. They thought it was a lot of fun, but they went with something else this year. And that was a bit of a letdown, but I was like, okay, I'll take the compliment, you know, and I'm very happy with the script. You know, like I said before, you know, worst case scenario, if I can walk away with a draft that I can use that I'm happy with, whether it's a writing sample or somebody passes on it and I can shop it around somewhere else, fantastic. The Christmas movie industry is a cottage industry. You know, Christmas isn't going anywhere. Christmas movies aren't going anywhere. Some could happen with this someday. About a year went by. I did not shop it around anywhere. We were kind of on a handshake deal at that point. And the idea was maybe we'll just try again. Now, nobody reached out to me in this year. And, you know, life went on and I had to do other things. But Christmas again rolled around and I saw the latest crop of Christmas movies that were on Netflix. They doubled the amount of ones that they were making. Hallmark kept making more and getting a little more experimental with the type of movies that they were making and not so cookie cutter, you know, with the kind of movies that they were known for. They were kind of branching out as well. They knew probably they had some competition. And I was watching all of them and I came into the next year like, I'm going to pick this up again. You know, time passed. And right around that spring again, I think I read the script after not looking at it for a while. Rereading that script, it was almost like you're, you know, reading something that somebody else wrote and therefore much easier to be like, oh, cut this. Shorten this. This could be better. Consolidate this. So I made some not crazy huge changes, just minor changes that made the thing read a little bit faster, flow a little better, improved some ideas that were already there. But like I said, from day one, the story itself was completely intact. And then emailed that same executive. I said, you know, hey, polish this up. Let's give it another shot. That summer, same thing happened where submitted it probably in June or July, maybe adhere to some minor notes. And I mean like really minor development notes. And some of those ideas were pretty good. Like for example, the little girl at the beginning of the story makes a Christmas wish. In the original script, it was going to see Santa Claus in town. But one of the notes I got from that executive was, let's just switch that because that's too played out. Let's make it a wishing tree. That's in the movie. Easy enough. And, you know, the magical Santa figure who may or may not be Santa, he's still there. Just kind of switched some things around. Like I said, minor changes like that, that made it just a little bit better overall. And then when that next August rolled around, they did the same thing. They submitted the scripts that they had to Netflix, and then Netflix gets to choose what they like. And then sure enough, I remember the day I was standing in line at Starbucks, which was the Starbucks that I did spend a lot of time writing the script in. And I got an email back that said, Netflix picked it up. And that was a good email to get back. I just remember it was like a shot of adrenaline. Like my heart started beating fast, started getting really nervous. I was like, oh, wow, this is real. This is good, but this is real. And I didn't know what was to come next, because that's when the pressure increases, when more eyes are on the project, when money starts to get behind it and other professionals. I knew that further, what they call studio notes, would be coming. I just didn't know when. This is the stage where not only are they looking at story content, but they're looking at budget. I did get notes from this particular production company and not yet Netflix. Some of the big notes that I looked over from them and a few more of their executives mainly had to do with the third act. The third act had a bigger action type of sequence, what former writer's program instructor Billy Murnett would call the love dash. It happens at the end of a lot of romantic comedies where the characters are rushing towards each other. This third act took place on a ski mountain, and Sierra's character was previously on a snowmobile racing towards the main character, Jake. And you think they're rushing towards each other, and it just so happens to be that they're on different paths of the mountain and they're about to totally miss each other. And the magical Secret Santa type character is at the top of the mountain making a snowman. In this previous draft, he was the one who kind of facilitated not only the whole magic of the ski accident in the beginning of the movie, which that is still in this final version of the movie, but he also facilitated a second accident. And as he was making the snowman at the top of the mountain, put a carrot on the snowman's head. The head falls off and rolls into a giant snowball, smacks into Sierra, knocks her off the snowmobile. She falls again in the snow right in front of the sleigh before Jake. And it kind of mirrors how Jake found her in the beginning. And he rushes over to her, but this time she doesn't have amnesia. She remembers everything. And then for budgetary reasons and also logistical reasons, such as shooting in the wintertime at cold at night with mechanical things like a snowmobile, they were just like, that's got to go. So I trimmed the entire ending and made it be that the press conference that already was in the story was happening at the very end. And the action sequence got cut, and it's just Jake going to her at the press conference. That was the biggest change at that stage, where the project was a go and some minor things were tweaked there as well. And I submitted that. The date on that draft was March 9th, 2020. And I was happy with that draft. I'm like, okay, this is a green light. We're doing budgetary changes. And I'm like dusting off my passport. I'm thinking about where I'm going to travel. Am I going to get to go to these ski resorts? Am I going to like get to hang out with the cast and crew wherever this movie's going to end up? And I'm just like flashing back to all those ski resorts that I looked at when I was doing research for this movie when I first began it. And days later, I think we know what happened after March 9th, 2020. The world had other plans. Like everybody, I was sent home on March 13th, 2020, working from home. And in the nature of my position, things got very crazy. Business, ironically, went up, and there was a lot of work to do and a lot of damage control. We were all kind of working in triage mode at that time. All film productions got grounded. All executives came home from wherever they were at. And I have a friend who also coincidentally had a project at Netflix through another production company and experienced something very similar to me, which is that the next set of notes that I got were from a dozen different voices, all for, in my case, it was in a text document or over an email. And it was like a color-coded conversation from AOL Instant Messenger or something like that. It looked like people were having an email conversation through a document talking about the script, and no one took the time to kind of consolidate this. So they just kind of like were probably also in some degree in their own triage mode of trying to figure out what to do next. What can we do with this project grounded? And they're all just probably hitting their development slate and doing what they can do, which is just read what they have on deck and try to get that into better shape while, you know, the world was going crazy with the onset of COVID. I didn't know how to make heads or tails of it. It was the equivalent of being in a boardroom at a studio and hearing multiple conflicting voices with different ideas that sometimes don't even go in the movie, or they're calling into question things that have like been in the outline since day one. It's like, whoa, okay. I did have a very good relationship, like I said, with the one executive that I was most close with and developing the story with. At that stage, I had a phone conversation with her. She was able to kind of distill the disorganized notes that I got and boil it down to what was really needed. It turns out, I think the one big note that I missed or didn't hit quite on the money was the main character has to be more likable in the beginning. In my draft, I think that the main character, because she's supposed to be a rich, spoiled, self-centered, selfish person, was skewing a little more towards that. To me, the point was she should not be likable in the beginning because she becomes likable in the end. That is the character arc. If she starts likable, then you kind of have to, it changes the trajectory of the story to a degree. I knew what they were getting at. I was like, okay, I can dial this down. I can do this and that. But when exactly do you need this draft? And they were like, in 2 weeks. At that time, I was losing my mind, not only handling work and everything that was happening in the world. I just had to take a minute. Like, they needed an answer while I was on that phone. I knew where I was at as a writer at that stage, and I was much better than the Hallmark movie I did before. I was much better than I was even in Kate Marciniak's class. I was happy with the script. I knew what they needed. I knew I could deliver it. I just couldn't deliver it at that time with everything that was happening in the time they needed it. And so I said exactly that on the phone. And then I just had to let go of the project and say, you know what, listen, I came to you, March 2018. This was the goal from the start. We got the script in shape. It's on the track to be made. It's almost there. And, I kind of like, in my mind, took the ball, ran it to the 2 yard line. And now we just need somebody to get it in shape, to get through production at the amount of money they need to make it under, and just, take it home. That's where I left the project. And she had mentioned another writer that she had in mind as well at the time. And I was familiar with this writer's work. So I was like, oh, that'd be great. Yeah, this person, I really like their Christmas movie, this and that. It should be a good fit. After that, time went by because of COVID and disruptions in the film industry. There was definitely a delay. The big question mark was how and when are productions ever going to come back? I didn't hear much. I would periodically check in, send a quick email just to take a temperature on where the project was at. The producer I was working with was nice enough to send me just quick updates, nothing major. And I was not offering any notes or doing any kind of writing whatsoever. I was at this point just kind of like a backseat driver. This may sound strange, but I always kept the faith. And I always, whether I'm writing it or after, had these little things that I would do to kind of manifest the initial dream or goal that I had. Namely, just as an example, might sound kind of silly, but to get in the Christmas mood when I was writing, I would listen to Christmas music and wear a Christmas hat. Even if it's at my table inside my apartment, just to kind of get yourself in that mindset, because it's not Christmas when it's July and it's the hottest day on record in Los Angeles. The air conditioner breaks or the power goes out on my block and I have to go to Starbucks with my laptop outdoors to write. And I'm like, this was literally a day that happened where it was 108 degrees. I think it was the July of 2018, maybe 19, one of those when I was actually in the process of doing the draft, just so I could be in an air conditioned place. And I'm walking up to Starbucks and it's almost like walking through a wall of heat. It was so hot in LA. I've never experienced heat like that. And in my headphones, I have Mariah Carey's Christmas music blaring in my ears. And I'm like, oh, this just feels disgusting. This should not be happening. This is just wrong on so many levels. But, you have to get into that mindset. So I would do stuff like that ever since writing that project from Christmas 2017 until it finally came out. I kept one wallpaper on my phone and it was an image of Christmas tree ornaments, Christmas balls on a table, and a couple glasses of champagne. Because to me, that kind of symbolized Christmas, but also a celebration at Christmas. I kept that wallpaper on my phone forever, for years, to the point where I got sick of it. But I just, every time I would look at it, because obviously everybody always looks at their phones, multiple times every day. It's just like subliminal bombardment where you just kept either thinking about the movie and getting ideas or just after the fact. One of the other things I did during this limbo period was, as Christmas was approaching, obviously I wasn't traveling home then. This will also sound a little strange. I had this new bottle of vitamin C and it had 375 pills of vitamin C. Got it from Target's, one of those bigger bottles. It was December 21st. I just thought to myself, this has to happen within a year's span of time. This movie should be made. I don't know how, but it's going to happen. I just feel it. And I wrote on that bottle, which is a bottle that you see every morning. You take your vitamins and you go about your day, staring at me at the cabinet every day. I just took a Sharpie and I wrote on the bottle the date, December 21st, 2020. And I said, factoring in 375 pills once a day, it's going to be a year from now. By the time this bottle is empty, Slopes will be in the can. And I put a bunch of dollar bill signs around it. Slopes referring to the previous development title of the script, which was called Christmas Off the Slopes. The title later changed to Falling for Christmas. And I saw that every single day. Open the cabinet, Slopes will be in the can, Slopes will be in the can. So stuff like that I would just do to kind of, even if it was out of my hands at the time, just kind of bring this thing into existence that I just felt could be a real movie. And then there were signs along the way as well, whether it was the time period where I was first looking to get the idea out there to pitch it. Once I started just telling a few people about it, I would also have opportunities to go hear some speakers at a class or an event. And these speakers were in the same wheelhouse of writing Christmas movies or Hallmark movies. So I got to ask them for advice and this and that. It was almost like the right people were showing up at the right time to get me to that next stage. Some people may call it like you set an intention out there and the universe conspires on your behalf to make it happen. Whatever you want to call it, coincidence, fate. I like to see it as signs and former. There was even a night where I was after work writing in a Starbucks. The Starbucks I was writing in was in Westwood Village. And I was sitting at a small table by the window. And it happened to be the same night that the remake of Overboard was premiering. And if you're familiar with Westwood Village, a lot of film premieres happen there. And the stars walk the red carpet and they walk into the movie theater that's right adjacent to that Starbucks. And the red carpet is leading there. And, you know, you see all the movie stars and Anna Faris walking in. I was just like alone after a long day of work with my laptop, plugging away at this Overboard knockoff at Christmas. And I'm like, oh man, one day that's going to be me. I didn't even know Overboard was being remade at the time. So that was just kind of another little wink from the universe. The next big piece of news happened on a day, you know, I woke up, it was in late May. Coincidentally, it was just one of those mornings where I thought, wow, you know, I haven't really heard about this in a while. So I'm going to send a quick email again to this producer and just check in and see where it's at. She wrote back that morning very quickly, said something about like, the news wasn't supposed to break. But somehow it got out. And I didn't know what she was referring to. My colleague who manages social media sent me a link to what was out on Twitter, which was the Variety article announcing that Lindsay Lohan was cast in a Christmas movie for Netflix. And my colleague's email said, isn't this your Christmas movie? And then I was just beside myself. So I got that at the same time I was getting more information from this producer. And I was just like, screaming at that point or speaking out loud at a high volume in my home office. What? Like Lindsay thing Lohan? Like I just, in my mind, this was supposed to be just your run of the mill Christmas movie, Hallmark or whatever. You know, they don't put, you know, very well-known movie stars in these stories. Netflix started to do that a little bit more as their Christmas movies became more popular, like Brooke Shields was in one and Carrie Ells, they were together in one. Rob Lowe was in one. But never in a million years did I expect Lindsay Lohan to get cast, also because she had essentially left acting for a movie. And then all of a sudden, Twitter was all over it. And Twitter, I think just by reading the log line in the trade articles, the hashtag Snoverboard was trending for a while. That seems to have fallen by the wayside when the film actually came out, but it was kind of funny to track hashtag Snoverboard at that time and reading what people were saying. Overall, they were pretty supportive of Lindsay and returning, and a lot of folks and fans were very happy out there. And there wasn't a lot of hate, which is kind of uncharacteristic, I think, for Twitter. That just, you know, shot my nerves through the roof because I was like, oh, wow, people are actually going to watch this now. This is not going to be an under-the-radar Christmas movie. This is the thing. Once she signed on, the ball got rolling. And that was around late May of 2021. Sure enough, they picked Park City, Utah as a location. They shot it in November and in December. By the time late December rolled around, as I wrote on the Sharpie on that bottle a year ago, that movie was done and it was in the can. Even leading up to that, there was so much uncertainty. I think that particular summer, maybe there was some other COVID variant that was ticking up like Delta or something like that. And I didn't know if this thing was going to even happen. They were moving forward. Obviously, at this stage, COVID protocols were in place for film and TV production. They were among the first industries to really get back to work with some type of code and protocol for these things and safety measures. They knew what to do, and they did it quite well. But I didn't know if it was going to get derailed again by the time, you know, fall rolls around, especially in Utah. That's winter almost. That's cold and flu season, et cetera. They're filming on location. Sometimes these movies do shoot in the summer in towns with fake snow. This was outdoors at a ski resort with real snow. And anything could have happened. Thankfully, the entire shoot went down from start to finish with not a single case of COVID. What I later found out was that after it finally wrapped, the very next week when people are just tearing everything down and getting ready to, you know, go home, most, if not all, of the crew that remained caught COVID. So thankfully, everybody was okay. But I just could not believe that, because if that happened during shooting, who knows what would have happened. I did get pinged in the summer of 2022 because there was a issue with how the writing credits were filed on paper, business-wise, legally, and everything. The production company was based also in Canada. This ultimately did go through the Writers Guild of Canada, just like if you're shooting at the States with union writers, you'd have to go through the Writers Guild of America. In the cases where especially film directors or producers even touch the script, what happens is your film automatically goes through what they call a credit arbitration process. Now, I wasn't familiar with any of this, even going through the classes that I've had and the experiences that I've had professionally and living and working in LA. I kind of knew of the process, but only thought it came up in, let's say, you know, copyright disputes and things like that. I knew that the WGA would sometimes step in on issues where credit was due and not given, or and sometimes, you know, you always hear the horror stories. And when I first got word of this process and I saw that the credits were filed incorrectly, I almost had like a minor heart attack because my name wasn't on there. After that, it was very quickly sorted out where I got a call from the producer or an email that was like very apologetic, like, I'm so sorry. You know, the way these things happen, they kind of get tossed back and forth between the companies and the lawyers and stuff. And sometimes you as a writer, the other writer that came aboard, or even the executives, they might not see this right away. By the time it actually did get to them, they noticed that it was just a clerical error and a misfiling. The whole thing got sorted out. They were like super sorry. And that kind of eased my woes there, because in the back of your head, having an overactive imagination, sometimes going to a worst case scenario, I'm like, am I going to be one of those horror stories after all this time and all this work? No, none of that happened. It was totally fine. Everything worked out. The credit was given as it definitely should have been. But through that process, what they do is they tell you to gather your work, presented in the, you know, and all the material that you sent. And then they have a panel of people in the union, whether it's here in America or Canada, wherever, panel of evaluators will read the drafts of the story, and they'll go draft to draft to see what was kept, what wasn't, what writer contributed what. And then they make the ultimate determination. In that process, you also get to see the new script. And that's when I first read the rewrite. And a super interesting process for me, almost looking at it like a case study between what I last left off on and what the next writer, who has done a lot of Christmas movies for Hallmark and a lot of other outlets before, and he's really good at doing that. And I could see how those notes were addressed, making the main character more likable in the beginning, kind of dialing down the whole spoiled girl aspect just a little bit, how they address some of the other notes differently than I would have. But it came out great. And I knew that on the page by reading the script, super happy with that. And then finally, when the movie came out, it was another layer of that weirdness where you're actually now watching something that people spent a lot of money and a lot of time to bring whatever ideas and characters were in your head to life. And you're seeing these characters at the same time the rest of the world is seeing these characters, you know, in 90 countries all around the world, in multiple languages, all leading up to Christmas. But in both instances, it was a really cool thing to see the differences in the stages of development, how they all kind of came through and worked their way through to a finished film. The film itself was received, I think, very well. I think it was in the top 10 streaming movies across all platforms in the 90 countries it was released in. It was number one on Netflix for a hot minute in terms of the Netflix, you know, movie top 10. And it got some cheeky reviews too. I think a lot of the critics out there, they like know it was supposed to be a cheesy Christmas movie. They're like, I shouldn't like this, but I like this. And they all had like, even though they would pick it apart at times, they would have nice things to say. And that was really cool. My favorite was IndieWire, where the title of the review, something about like Falling for Christmas is the Citizen Kane of Netflix Christmas movies, which was hilarious. Looking back in hindsight, I think during this dormant period while the film was in development, as excruciating as it was and how things were so uncertain, will it ever be made and see the light of day? I think that period could have been a blessing in disguise, and here's why. While it was big news at the time when Lindsay Lohan signed on and was cast in the lead role, all throughout development, there was a long time there where people were obviously homebound and wherever they were living were under certain types of COVID restrictions. Lindsay was located in Dubai. And during the press cycle for Falling for Christmas, I, you know, had my Google alerts set up and I was trying to follow everything that was out there in the press when she was doing interviews. And I happened to catch an interview where she had mentioned that she really started to reflect on her career as an actor while on lockdown during COVID. And I think that it was during that time she really had that yearning, as she said, to be back on a movie set and be back into that mode of creating and collaborating. I'm sure, like any actor would, eyeing a return to the craft, probably contacted her people, and then her people put out the the beacon and looking at what would be a suitable role and movie for her to return with. Fortunately for me, she had reported in yet another interview that this was the first script that she picked up that she really loved and thought it would be the perfect fit. So I think it could have been a blessing in disguise, because maybe if COVID didn't happen and I did just, get a draft made faster once I delivered it in March 9th and rewrote it myself and it got on the fast track for production after that, there could be some parallel universe where Lindsay's not in this movie and it didn't get as much attention as it did. And it just would have been what I thought it would be from the beginning, which was just your run-of-the-mill Christmas movie. So at the end of the day, I was super happy that she signed on and chose that as her comeback vehicle. And not only did the world get to experience the Christmas movie when it was released and enjoy that, but probably some other Lindsay Lohan projects in the future. So you're welcome, Lohan fans. My advice to any writer out there looking to break into either film or TV writing is mainly to keep the faith. I've been at this a long time, but I don't write all the time. I think that's a big misconception. I heard the writer of Jaws speak in a class once. His name's Carl Gottlieb. He said there are two types of writers. There are habitual writers and there's deadline writers. I definitely think I'm the latter. Taking classes, having deadlines and accountability and learning new tools, getting out of my head and getting out of the places where I was getting stuck just working on my own only started to happen when I began taking classes and putting myself in an environment where there was accountability, where there was deadlines, also learning new skills and developing yourself, getting more comfortable speaking your ideas and also giving other people notes on their work. And, it just kind of has this snowball effect over time where you just learn as you go and get better in somewhat of a safer environment. So when the time comes to actually write something or pitch something, you're ready. For me, having those classes, a lot of which were here at the Writers Program from day one till now, have been just a total game changer for me. The only other piece of advice I could say besides that, when you set out to do something, you really have to have conviction and faith that it's going to happen. Like I said earlier, my way of mitigating this one project, Falling for Christmas, I was mitigating mentally the idea of success or failure. At the end of the day, I knew that at the very least, I would walk away with a good writing sample to have that I could use either to get representation or to pitch to eventually sell to any of the number of outlets out there that make similar types of Christmas movies. So having the faith and having that conviction and believing in yourself, as cheesy as it sounds, I think is definitely a big component. And lastly, just to break apart this misconception, you don't have to have an agent or a manager. I still don't. I've had a number one movie on Netflix. You think that when you get to this point, things are going to magically happen. It's always an uphill battle, even to write the next thing, face the blank page, pitch the next project. You just have to keep going like I am right now. And if you're just starting out, sometimes query letters is the best you can do. And you start there. And it could lead somewhere. So that's my advice, is just, sign up for an IMDb Pro account, write your material and get it out there in any way that you can, even if it's signing up for Twitter and tweeting your favorite filmmakers out there.
The Right Process is hosted and curated by me, Charlie Jensen. This season was produced by Jamie Moss. The Writers Program offers courses, certificates, and services that help writers achieve their writing goals one page at a time. For more information, visit writers.uclaextension.edu.